Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Rima Katz. Today, fraud is incredibly rampant in every aspect of our lives, particularly when paying for goods and services. While it's still an ongoing challenge for many, there have been recent advancements in its prevention, thanks in large part to artificial intelligence and machine learning. Today's podcast guests include Dave Excel, founder at Featurespace, Bruce Diesel, global head of product for dynamic payments at Diebold Nixdorf, and our own Marco Salazar, director of technology and infrastructure at Mercator Advisory Group. They dive into how financial institutions can leverage data to help fight fraud, and why consumer education is absolutely critical and cannot be fear-based, as that will be detrimental to overall acceptance. They also offer insights into how FIs can use their fraud strategy and ensure that it strikes the right balance between being more visible while being less intrusive. Dave, Bruce, and Marco, it's great to have you with us today. To start, Dave, I'm curious how increased data sharing within banks and financial institutions is affecting the payment space.
Well, I think it's a really interesting question and almost one in terms of like, why is the question in the first place, in terms of why is data sharing something that we're talking about? And I guess I think about how the banking and financial industry has sort of evolved, especially over the last 20 or 30 years in terms of adding new ways to pay, new products and services. And those have sort of been incrementally added piecemeal over the time with new pieces of technology that sort of come in to augment what's already within inside those institutions. And often those systems haven't really talked to each other. They've come with their own limits. They've come with their own platforms, their own data specifications, all of those types of things. And creating interoperability between them has always been challenging. And then I guess we've seen the rapid rise of digitization, which is anything new, but also the customer experience of wanting everything to be immediate and fast and readily accessible. And we've seen, especially within Europe, the advent of sort of open banking and then that coming through more into the North American and sort of global markets as well. And then if I also think about the risks that are in place in terms of what fraudsters are able to do, they're often looking at where they can sort of commit fraud and where the sort of minimal oversight is in terms of if they want to do something which is against what the bank wants them to do, how can they hide amongst all of that data that's really there? So when I'm thinking about data sharing, it's really about how can the banks and financial institutions really have a consistent view around what the customer is doing, what is the customer experience, and how can we start to identify what are the behaviors that we want them to do, what's expected, and where do we start to see either fraud, which is due to an account being compromised or a customer being scammed and that interaction being unusual or out of sync in terms of what we'd expect that customer to do. So data sharing sort of enables the banks to be able to protect the customer, but also to create new experiences for that customer and sort of new products and services to meet those real-time needs and those requirements.
Yeah, and I think fundamentally, if you just break it down to basics, increased data sharing is increased opportunities for fraud at the end of the day. You know, it's as basic as that. And it also means an increased volume of transactions, which means, again, an increased opportunity, a bigger attack surface area for fraud. So both of those, you know, variables have increased the need and the requirement on the fraud system. So absolutely, you know, it provides benefits, but then on the same side of that coin, it creates bigger stresses.
And along those lines, just the data sharing is able to create just new experiences overall, in the sense that while there is data sharing across business units or even third parties, which goes to that point that there is more opportunity with fraud, the actual sharing itself is also comes as a result of standardization of these data elements, which if done correctly across business units and third parties, allows for broader detection of fraud before it even begins across a wider array of products. And so while it's almost like this delicate fine balance that needs to be played when thinking about data sharing.
And I guess one of the things that we know is that the fraudsters are sharing data amongst themselves, either through compromises that they're able to make and then selling and sharing that data amongst themselves. And then I think we've got the opportunity to apply like advanced technologies with AI and machine learning to really sort of get to utilize that data to provide that protection for customers in those real-time environments as well.
Yeah, bad news usually travels faster than good news. I think the fraud systems are faster than the systems that are trying to combat it. And that's why we have to, you know, we have to bring in these techniques to get ahead of them.
Yeah, and along the lines of machine learning and artificial intelligence, those models just need large amounts of data in order to work properly. But this only happens if the data is standardized, is normalized. Well, yeah,
it's the quality of data at the end of the
day.
Exactly. You can't build ML and AI on poor quality data. It's not a tool for improving the quality of data.
Exactly. It's garbage in, garbage out. And yeah, in this case, you're trying to obviously improve the quality of the data from the onset.
Yeah.
And that's going to help scale, not just scale these solutions, but actually increase their robustness.
We've seen better controls and new regulations that have been designed to improve authentication, but still scams are skyrocketing. How can FIs identify and protect against this when consumers self-transact?
A common pattern that you see is that the more high-tech the anti-fraud and security systems become, the more low-tech the scams become, you know. And the only way, you know, in my opinion, you can combat the low-tech side of things is in consumer education. You can't just rely on technology. You can't just throw this over the fence to our technology friends and say, solve the problem. At the end of the day, there's social engineering. There's all sorts of things going on that enable, you know, low-tech fraud to proliferate. So I always, you know, advise, go back to the education, consumer education and awareness components of this, and I think that's critical.
Yeah, and I guess for me, there's also one way in which we can sort of say the industry's done well is we've been able to apply technology in a way that has increased the level of authentication, which has meant things like account takeover and phishing type attacks are harder for the fraudsters to do. And as they're operating their own businesses, they want to go to the lowest cost route in terms of where they can monetize their activity. And I guess, unfortunately, they are going to, well, where's the lowest barrier? And it comes back to us sometimes in terms of circumnavigating and sort of those protections that are put in place. But we've seen ways in which, again, we can apply machine learning to be able to identify where are there customers which are more likely to be susceptible to scams, and when can we start to see interaction which is outside of what we would be expecting them to do. And alongside things like customer education is also looking at, well, what is the right, not every transaction needs to be real time. Mm-hmm. So can we actually slow a transaction down potentially? And how do we communicate to those customers to give them a little bit more chance to sort of maybe have some remorse set in and go back and actually be able to cancel or stop the transaction before it goes through?
Yeah, manual rules-based systems just can't keep up with it. I mean, you have to get to pattern-based systems, ML and AI type of systems at the end of the day. And because at the end of the day, that behavior is not, you know, it's unique to an individual level. It's not, you know, one person's fraudulent behavior is another person's normal behavior. And suddenly you're in a world of one-to-one massive differentiation between each individual, and the only tools really are things like AI and ML.
Yeah, and the fraudsters can do even basic things. So I've seen them where they've contacted a customer service representative of a customer account that they've been able to take over, and they phoned and said, I can't get this transaction through. Can you enable it for me? And the person on the other end have said, oh, that's because our fraud rule set at $1,000. If you try something just below that, I'm sure it will go through, sort of enabling the fraud to take
place. Absolutely, yeah.
Where's the balance between customer experience and customer protection?
I gave this a bit of thought. I was just prepping for this conversation now, and I kind of try to distill what is that balance point. And I think the balance point, and again, it gets to what we were just talking about, it's probably unique to each individual. But at the end of the day, there's a balance point where consumers are prepared to accept an amount of friction to get the protection they get. So at the end of the day, and again, this depends on the size of the transaction and all sorts of things like that. But at the end of the day, the consumer has to be willing to accept that amount of friction from protection systems to get the protection that they want and make them feel safe. So that's the balance point. Unfortunately, it's probably as individually unique as a lot of these other behavioral patterns. But I think that's the balance point. The friction needs to be at a tolerable level to the consumer. The problem really becomes is that this is actually an omni-channel problem. Because we're saying we're going to give you so much convenience, you can transact through the channel of your choice. We're not going to impose on you which channel you're going to use. You want to be able to use whichever channel you like. Suddenly, you need to be consistent across all of those channels. And this goes back to, you know, in the first question, the point that data needs to be well shared and it needs to be real time shared between channels, and not, and most banks are still operating in a very siloed manner in these channels. So this really creates a significant challenge to create that omni-channel balance point where the friction is only as much as the consumer is prepared to tolerate for the protection they want in the environment.
Yeah, and I'd like to add along those lines that it basically comes down to providing a way for consumers to permission access to that data. So what that means is usually when a new payment method emerges, it's going to need access to specific types of data. But the consumer is now savvy, especially the younger, more technology savvy consumers, they understand that data needs to be accessed, but they want to be able to say, yes, you can access it, or no, you cannot. And once that's established, the consumers are willing to try these new instruments, these new experiences, and they understand that data needs to be shared in order to have these experiences. And so what that has done now is that it has created this environment where, especially here in the US, where firms have to account for that. They have to be able to provide a permissioned access to data. And a lot of this is stemming from what has happened within big tech, right? The hacks that occurred with Facebook is probably the most notable one, but that has also led to backlash from not just consumers, but also the regulating bodies. And so what we're starting to see is an environment in which regulators across the globe are looking into this to see and understand how is data being shared, how is it being accessed, and do consumers ultimately have the final say? You look at the EU with GDPR and PSD2, while they have their challenges in of themselves, they are the gold standard today. They still are. And they do one thing. They allow the consumer to essentially say, this data is mine, and prove ownership of it, and allow them to revoke access to the data, essentially. And what that's happened is the consumers are now empowered to say, we give you permission or not, which is leading to be honest, a great deal of integrated experiences that you have to be able to prove the value through these experiences. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, consumers will turn on you and they will revoke access.
And I think experience is really key. So one of the things that when like 3D Secure was introduced in Europe is we were working with some merchants and they were looking at, well, they would introduce 3D Secure as that additional sort of authentication step. So it was friction into the customer experience, but then it became normalized for them. And then we were looking at, well, now we know the customer, we trust the customer, so we don't need to enable the authentication all the time. But as we started to reduce that, they felt that the transactions were less secure. So it had became normalized, and they wanted it to be there because then they knew that their account was being secured and looked after as well. But I also think it's like part of that, again, the experience. So even with my own sort of personal banking, I constantly get told, well, you're logging in from a new device. We need to authenticate the device with a one-time password. And I'm going, this is the same device I always use. So when the implementation isn't good, then it starts to reduce your trust in what's going on.
Yeah. The other problem is, how do we achieve that on a global scale? You know, you got regional regulatory capabilities, but you know, how do we actually, and that must be the next challenge, is there is no global body, regulatory body that can impose a lot of this, you know, at a global level. And, you know, I think that becomes the next challenge as to where that data flows, where it sits with cloud technology the way it is today. You know, that data, where is it at the end of the day? And under which regulatory body does it exist? Very challenging.
It's an interesting topic, especially since if we take a historical view on things, the card networks essentially dictated how payment data was going to be accessed on a global scale. They set the standards. And if you look at their history and their makeup, a lot of them are US-based, which is a very different model. It's very capitalistic in nature in comparison to other regions like the EU, like in India now, where they're more consumer first. And so from that standpoint, it's almost like we are headed towards this path of a reckoning. And what is emerging, and the reason I say that is because we have technology who is pushing and whose goals are to scale. So if they can take one iteration of a product and scale it globally, that is their goal. But unfortunately, regulators have caught on and have put in localization mandates where that is now impossible. And to that point, I think from a technology standpoint, there will be a layer of compliance, and more so in the sense of how do you comply with these data norms? So in India, there's a localization where data has to be stored there. And so there's that component. There's also the component of, well, what data elements can be shared? How are they going to be shared? What is their actual structure? And so while there are a lot of initiatives like ISO 222, which in theory, could solve a lot of these things. The problem still remains the implementation, which is a lot of the challenges with PSD2, in that the spirit of it is great, but the actual implementation across every country in the EU has been a challenge. And to that point, that's why I kind of rely or I think it will be solved through this orchestration or slash compliance layer that has not really existed in the past.
I mean, it's an interesting point that you make there because, you know, at the end of the day, the American, like you say, the big card networks, you know, from their perspective, they are trying to, the focus of their protection or reduction of risk are the FIs. They want to reduce the risk of the FIs. Whereas in the, like you say, in the other environment, the European environments, the focus of the risk management is on the consumer. So those are, you know, the actual mechanisms being put in place, the risk, what they're trying to address from a risk perspective are different. Their focus is different. So it won't necessarily scale the compliance or regulatory done in one market that is focused on reducing the risk of the enterprise versus another market where the focus of the risk is reducing the risk of the consumer. They're actually almost opposing requirements.
Which is then challenging when we want to be able to travel ourselves and have a consistent experience when we're moving between different geographies as well without having to think about all of the complexities that's going on behind the scenes.
As a European, you think everything is based around reducing your own personal risk. Well, that might not necessarily be the case.
And that's where the challenge comes in with big tech, right? I mean, they keep spreading their tentacles. And in a way, yes, that you are handing a lot of information to them. But they have this global footprint where they are user-centric and they are trying to make these experiences very consumer-centric. But the challenge there is how much is too much? And consumers as well as regulators need to be able to strike a balance there.
Marco, you've touched upon regulation quite a bit. What implications do new techniques have on compliance and regulatory mandates?
So the challenge with the regulation and compliance is that these mandates take a long time to hit the market. So I'll use an example. Cryptocurrency obviously is in the news today, but if we really look at it, these cryptocurrency firms, the providers, as well as the actual exchanges, et cetera, the entire ecosystem has been craving or demanding some sort of regulatory framework because in essence, they want to be able to scale their services, but they want to be able to do it. Obviously, they're trying to make money, but at the same time, they want to be able to provide a consumer experience that is safe and encourages mass adoption. Now, in order for that to happen, we need participation from the entire ecosystem. And so in this case, there has been a lot of institutions that have been holding out or just waiting on the sidelines, and primarily they're mostly the risk averse. So think of the FIs, and rightfully so. Look at what's happened. And so from that angle, this all comes down to how fast can the regulatory bodies produce these mandates so that the industry can actually know what rules they have to play by. A lot of times technology advances and is innovating way faster than the regulatory bodies can catch up. And so from that perspective, it has to come to kind of, you kind of have to look at the models, right? In the US, you're innovating. It's a much more capitalistic market where the industry is allowed to innovate before the regulation hits. In the EU, it's a little bit different, where the regulations usually tend to be a lot faster than the US, but they're also, again, they're very consumer centric. And again, it's this, I call it a healthy friction, right? Because you still need, firms need to be able to make money and monetize their services, but at the same time need to be able to provide consumers with those protections. And so it's very impactful in the sense that you need the rules by which you abide by, but at the same time, you also need to have the freedom and creativity to innovate. And consumers, I think, are the X factor in the sense that they can clamor and demand for services, which then accelerates a lot of these efforts on either end.
I have a question for David on this situation. So at the end of the day, I mean, regulatory compliance is largely tied into liability. If I'm compliant and I comply with all regulations, I'm not liable for a fraud. So if we have a situation of a learning system, you know, an ML AI type of system where, you know, weighting factors are being adjusted as it's learning, how do you backtrack in time when a decision got made incorrectly? Okay, so it said, okay, this is not a fraud, and it was a fraud and somebody lost. Now, how do you go back and say, that decision was made at that point in time with these weighting factors as to how, so whose liability is it now? Because that system's evolving. How do you backtrack that? And I'm really fascinated to try and understand, do you not allow it to learn that quickly? Do you freeze it? What is the process there? Because at the end of the day, where we are today, a decision or a liability or a loss is encountered sometime in the past. Now you've got to unravel that. Whose liability is it? Which what failed? Did it fail because the decision was made incorrectly, or, and then how do you actually go back to a snapshot in time and say that was the current state of the AI at that point in time?
It's a great question. And I think like the liability issue is usually one that's more dictated by the rules of the payment network or the scheme that's in place. So like a good example is like for a card not present or an online transaction, if the bank goes through, or the transaction goes through a 3D secure path and the bank authenticates that transaction and allows it, then they hold the liability, versus if the transaction doesn't go through that route, then the merchant can hold the liability within the different sort of, and PSD2 sort of adds another layer on top of that. So that often dictates sort of who's ultimately liable for the fraud that takes place. But I think there's a sort of the other part of your question in terms of how quickly you can learn. And I think there's one of the things that we know about fraud is it takes time to actually know that fraud has taken place. It's very different to placing a marketing ad on a website and presenting it and say, well, did the customer actually click on the ad or not? You get very fast feedback in terms of, was it the correct ad placement to make? And so that has to be something that's built into the framework of how does the machine learning model, what is the governance that sits around that? And it factors into some of the regulatory compliance around, are we learning around factors that don't create bias around some of the protected classes that come through. But at the same time,
is regulation up to speed with that, or is it still got to catch up?
Yeah, but I think it's also important for the models to be relatively reactive. So we saw during the lockdown of COVID is there was a huge shift in terms of how consumers spent, and our models were able to react within a matter of days to those changes of behavior. Patterns. But if we were relying on fraud strategies of the past, is we may have interfered and declined a lot of transactions where people were scrambling to sort of change how they purchased and interacted. So we need systems as well that can adapt with how society wants to interact as well as the fraud at the same time.
And just to add to that, to David's point, it's really a commercial component, right? The goal here is to pass approved transactions and minimize the fraudulent activity. So in essence, in these periods of transition where new behaviors are discovered, you may see a spike in the fraud. But merchants, you have to remember, want to be able to complete those sales. And they're willing to take on that extra liability because it's averaged over time. And so that's how a lot of these solutions are priced, in the sense that, hey, we're going to increase your approval rates by 50%. And your fraud rate will essentially decline to just under the card networks, which I think hover at around 3%. And so if you can do that over time, you can manage these spikes while the algorithms learn. And so again, it's a commercial component where the pricing, and I've seen some interesting pricing strategies that account for these spikes as well. And so you can do that now because technology allows it to do that in real time, essentially.
As we're nearing the end of this discussion, it'd be interesting to hear how FIs can use their fraud strategy as a key differentiator. I want to throw this as a lightning round to everyone, starting off with Dave.
I think it can be huge in terms of being a differentiator. And I think we've seen a number of financial institutions sort of actively advertise what they do around their fraud controls, and also in terms of educating consumers around like scams that are taking place. And I think we do see ultimately it's the reputation of the financial institution and that brand loyalty that's at risk. So even in the United States, where some of the like authorized push payments or scams, ultimately the consumer is technically liable for those, that fraud. But we do see a number of financial institutions reimbursing that just to create that brand loyalty and reputation within the market. So I think it's a huge differentiator for FIs to be able to protect their customers and sort of keep their money safe, which is one of the main reasons why we want to use a bank in the first place rather than keep the cash under the mattress.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think it's you have to look at it from two sides, right? The consumer as well as the merchant. And you have to strike that balance between the two. So from the merchant side, it's how are these solutions integrated into the overall offering, right? Is it embedded and it's almost just included with the actual payment processing or within the e-commerce tool? Many times that's what's preferred in the sense of it depends on who you're talking to, right? If it's a tier one who has the resources and talent to actually manage each individual component, that's a different story than your smaller merchants who essentially want a black box and want everything done for them. On the consumer side, and just to add to David's point, it's essentially how can I get my good? How can I complete my transaction without any additional step ups or friction within the process? And usually that can be done through different technology methods, I would say. But again, it's how invisible can we make it without the consumer thinking that they're not protected?
Yeah. And, you know, I would like to just focus on the trust component. At the end of the day, financial institutions, their brand is about trust. You know, bottom line, it's all about trust. So fraud strategies and trust, it can be built into that trust component. So communicating fraud strategy and that does contribute to the trust in the brand. I think what's quite important though is that a lot of consumers perceive fraud to be a bit of a victimless crime if they're not directly sort of impacted themselves. You know, yeah, fine, the bank's got a lot of money and they got taken for a bit of money and it doesn't impact me. So at the end of the day, another differentiator can become to start to build in how that fraud can, the benefits of improving or reducing fraud can actually benefit the consumer directly and potentially some consumer education around that, maybe innovative ways to get consumers to benefit from reduction in fraud rather than them just seeing this as a victimless crime that really doesn't impact them directly unless they get scammed.
You've all covered so much. Definitely a key takeaway for me here is that fraud management is certainly a critical part of the payments ecosystem. Dave, Bruce, and Marco, thank you so much again for sharing your insights and perspective. We hope to have you back here soon.